This is the NPR News Update podcast for Tuesday, May 26. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. Coming up, we hear from a pollution control citizen board member who might not have a board to return to. Minnesota is getting closer to medical marijuana. Some health clinics in the state are adding lawyers to help patients. And we get a moose update. First, two people are dead and another injured in a shooting at a Walmart store in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Tim Nelson has more.
Police say they were called to the Walmart Supercenter shortly after 1 a.m. on a report of shots fired. Officers initially thought the shooting might be ongoing, but said they quickly determined there was no further danger. Police spokesman Lieutenant Derek Zimmel said that two people were killed, including one person they believe was the assailant. A third person was injured.
I believe a handgun was located at the scene. I don't have any information beyond that.
The U.S. Air Force said that an airman from the nearby Grand Forks Air Base was also involved and that military investigators have joined the case. Neither the dead nor the injured have yet been identified. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A young boy is in critical condition after he and his older brother were pulled from an abandoned swimming pool yesterday in St. Paul. Fire Marshal Steve Zachard says there was a 5-foot fence and locked gate around the pool, which was filled with dirty water, but the children were able to either climb over or crawl under the fence.
Parents should remind their children that, you know, if there's a fence and a locked gate, it means stay out. If there's a warning sign, it's for your own good. Don't be going where you shouldn't be because it is dangerous.
Zachard says the fire department wants to be notified of other abandoned pools that could be dangerous to children. Six people are facing potential criminal charges in a series of water attacks on pedal pubs over the weekend. Elizabeth Baer caught up with one of the perpetrators.
The men were arrested Saturday after allegedly squirting water guns at pedal pubs at three different locations in downtown Minneapolis. Six off-duty Burnsville police officers were among the pedal pub passengers. They held cyclists until Minneapolis police arrived. 31-year-old Curtis Johnson of Inver Grove Heights says he was one of the men squirting at the pedal pub passengers. He says the off-duty officers used excessive force.
You can't take a joke and think that there's something more to it than just water. I mean, you got to take a big look at your life if you think that we're out to try to hurt people. We're just having fun.
Johnson says he and the other men arrested are considering legal options. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Dayton and House Speaker Kurt Dowd are meeting today to start working out last-minute deals on several fronts. Dayton has vetoed three major bills passed by lawmakers in the final hours of the legislative session last week. That means he will have to call a special session to avoid a partial state government shutdown July the 1st. The omnibus Agriculture, Environment, and Natural Resources bill is one of the three Dayton vetoed. That bill drew particular ire from environmentalists for its elimination of a citizens board at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Dr. Dan Foley has been a member of the citizens board for more than 30 years. He talked with Kathy Werzer this morning.
Could you explain for listeners, what does that citizens board do exactly?
Well, actually, it is the agency. If you look at the law, collectively, the citizens board plus the commissioner is the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And then we have a staff.
Were you surprised at the move by the legislature to include this language in the omnibus environmental bill?
At the beginning, I was. I sometimes think you don't know what you have till it's gone. But I do understand why the legislature got it. It's a unique structure in the agencies of state government to have eight citizens plus a commissioner actually be the agency. So every once in a while, people take a look at that and say, well, why is it different from DNR or the health department, et cetera? You may remember that years ago, we also had a health board. So there was a similar type structure at the Department of Health. And the only one that still remains is the Pollution Control Agency.
Do you think there was one recent decision in particular that spurred lawmakers to move to eliminate the board?
I don't know that. I hear rumors that there was a particular dairy decision that we made to require an environmental impact statement that has caused some folks to go to the legislators and talk about changing the structure of the agency.
What's your gut feel here in terms of the survival of the board?
I think there's probably a good chance because the commissioner and the governor are opposed to eliminating the citizen component of the board. One of the things, Kathy, that the citizens board, the board meetings provide for the citizens, one is a forum for discussion about issues where proposers, as well as the state and environmental groups or individual citizens, can hear in plain language what are the environmental issues that a potential permit would allow a proposer to do, knowing full well that every permit is a permit to pollute to a certain level. And so having that forum where people can actually hear in plain language, not jargon, not all of the scientific aspects, even though everything that we do has to be heavily based in the law and science, for a lot of people, that's a difficult language. And we force a plain language discussion.
And you still think in this day and age there is use for the citizens board?
Well, I do. I think it's very important that you have a broad-based forum where we can give input to the commissioner who has the fiscal authority, and we collectively, so the commissioner plus four members, five votes are required in order for any of this permitting to take place.
Doctor, thank you for the information.
You're welcome.
Dan Foley and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. Medical marijuana will become legal in Minnesota in just over a month. Providers and the state are getting ready, and they will even be using smartphones as part of the process. We go back to Tim Nelson for more.
This summer, Minnesota will join 22 other states that have legalized some form of marijuana. But Kyle Kingsley, an emergency medicine doctor and CEO of Minnesota Medical Solutions, says his company wants the state to stand apart when medical cannabis is legal. The company is one of two licensed in Minnesota to provide medical marijuana. And when MidMed opens its dispensary in Minneapolis, the company will have registered pharmacists, an elaborate dispensing protocol, and a smartphone app to help patients give the company feedback about its products.
Our plan is to build an application that will allow patients, based on their condition and their symptoms, to give us feedback in real time with the medications that they're using. And initially, it's going to be very simple.
There's limited clinical information available now on the drug, but Kingsley says research and data is built into the system that Minnesota set up to legalize medical marijuana.
We're not sure exactly what it's going to look like on July 1st, but moving ahead, we hope that this ends up being a robust application that be very helpful in not only catering to specific patients and making sure that we optimize their care, but this data that we collect will be helpful in driving long-term trends in what medications we make.
And the company won't be alone. The Minnesota Department of Health is also planning to monitor patients that buy the drug. Manny Munson-Regala is an assistant state health commissioner.
When folks will show up at the patient centers, either before they come in for their monthly supply or while they're there, they'll fill out a sort of self-reported series of questions, a survey, essentially identifying, is this stuff working for them? Have they had to change? What additional medications have they moved to? Try to get a sense of, what's working and what's not working.
The state estimates about 5,000 patients will initially register for a state program that will allow them to purchase and use the drug. State officials say they won't know until people actually sign up how much interest there'll be. The registry opens June 1st. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Some Minnesota healthcare clinics are adding on-site attorneys to their teams of doctors and nurses. These clinic-based lawyers provide convenient, free legal service to low-income patients. The idea of medical legal partnerships has been around for a while, and in this era of healthcare reform, lawyers are playing a bigger role improving the health of some patients. Lorna Benson explains.
When Eric Campbell's diabetes spiraled out of control last summer, he knew that his nearly empty pantry was to blame. An unexpected $130 cut to his monthly food support income from Hennepin County meant he had just $2 a day to spend on food.
Well, I was eating mostly like rice and potatoes and stuff, but see, those are starchy foods. And by them being starchy foods, then they're not good for me, my diabetes.
At the time, Campbell had just moved into a small apartment in Robbinsdale after living in a homeless shelter. His newly established disability benefits helped him pay for the apartment, but not much else. So he was surprised when Hennepin County suddenly decreased his food support by more than two-thirds. But Campbell figured it would be simple to plead his case once the county saw how little money he had for food.
Yeah, I went to the office several times and explained to the lady, "That's no possible way your calculations is right." It's like talking to a wall.
As the dispute dragged on, Campbell's health deteriorated quickly. His nurse practitioner, Annie Goldbaum, says her patient's blood glucose rose to an alarming level.
All of a sudden, his A1C went from being like 6.5 to like 11.5, so his blood sugars went up double.
Campbell's kidneys started to fail, and the 44-year-old was added to a transplant list. Goldbaum says her patient was in mortal danger, and she couldn't do much to save him.
Nothing, really. I mean, giving him some food from our food pantry, but I didn't think in no way would it have been enough to sustain him.
But Goldbaum had a colleague in her Minneapolis primary care clinic who she thought could help. Attorney Carrie Graff runs the medical legal partnership between Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid and Hennepin County Medical Center's Whittier Clinic. For the past 2 years, the arrangement has provided convenient, free legal assistance to Whittier patients with the goal of improving their health. Graff agreed to meet with Campbell during his next clinic visit, and she got permission from Hennepin County to review his case file.
There was a pretty substantial error that had been made.
After talking with Graff, county officials acknowledged the mistake and agreed to restore her client's food support. Graff says other Hennepin County residents also benefited from the discussion of Campbell's case.
And in further conversations with the county, it turned out this is an error they were making, you know, for about 200 food stamp recipients. And these are all people who are living, you know, right on the edge of you know, not being able to feed themselves.
The Whittier Clinic has the second medical legal partnership in the state. The first one started more than 20 years ago at the Community University Healthcare Center in Minneapolis. A third partnership launched this spring at a St. Cloud clinic. And Hamline University School of Law is also setting up a medical legal partnership with a clinic in St. Paul. Graff says these arrangements are gaining traction because health reform has forced hospitals and clinics to look more at the whole patient.
And they're realizing that in order to provide really great care that's affordable, they need to be looking at all of the circumstances that are contributing to a patient's health.
Nurse Annie Goldbaum agrees. She says her colleagues knew that free legal help could make a big difference in the health of many Whittier patients. But she says some providers did wonder if the arrangement might also hurt their practice.
And I think there was some concern from some people, like, whoa, we're bringing lawyers into the clinic. Does that mean that, you know, our patients are going to get legal help if they have some kind of medical malpractice concern? But that hasn't come up at all.
Funding is likely the biggest challenge facing the growth of medical legal partnerships. There is no dedicated, consistent source of money to pay for these projects. Most collaborations receive contributions from multiple partners, including legal groups, hospitals, universities, and foundations. That cost sharing makes these arrangements possible for now, but also vulnerable to any downturn in the partners' finances. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Every creature needs food and shelter to survive, and Minnesota's beleaguered moose is no exception. Their population has plummeted in recent years. At latest count, it's down 60% to over 4,000 animals. Now, a coalition of groups is spending millions of dollars to restore moose habitat in northeastern Minnesota, part of a last-gasp effort to save the animal. Dan Crocker reported for us on Friday.
In a remote forest north of Finland, Minnesota, workers are planting slender cedar and white pine seedlings in a clearing where the underbrush has been cleared away. They move quickly. One person can plant about 3,000 trees a day. Ron Moen is a longtime moose researcher with the University of Minnesota Duluth.
What's being planted is conifers, and eventually, in 15 to 20 years, they're going to be high enough to provide shade for moose.
Moose need those big trees to stay cool, but they also need food. That's why, before the seedlings were planted, crews in the winter first sheared the brush down to the ground so it would re-sprout at a level where moose could reach it.
You can see with basically the shearing that went on, there's food that's within reach of moose.
Moen says moose require a patchwork of two very different kinds of habitat across the landscape.
They need mature forests and they need younger forests. The mature forest is for shelter, younger forests is for food.
But that young forest is getting harder for moose to find in Minnesota. Mike Schrag, a wildlife biologist with the Fond du Lac Ojibwe Band, blames two factors, a decline in logging and an aggressive approach to putting out most wildfires. Without those disturbances, he says, there aren't many places for new trees to sprout.
Moose need good places to eat and cover to make a living. You know, we need to act quickly and aggressively, I think, if we're going to turn our moose numbers around.
Scientists don't know exactly what's behind the precipitous drop in moose numbers in Minnesota. They suspect it's a combination of climate change, disease and parasites, predators, and habitat loss. That's where this project comes in. It's a collaborative between a number of government agencies, tribes, and nonprofit groups. With nearly $3 million in funding from the state's legacy amendment sales tax, they plan to treat about 8,500 acres across northeast Minnesota. They'll use prescribed burns, remove brush, plant trees, and harvest timber to create the new habitat.
These couple of trees have been, they've been browsed on for a number of years.
Nearby, Schrag points out a patch of forest moose visited recently.
Some of these branches back here broken off, you know, 6 feet off the ground, that's moose grabbing twigs and pulling the branch over to get what they want. Well, they wind up snapping some of the bigger branches, and sometimes individual trees, certain locations, is just like ice cream for moose, and they just keep coming back and hitting it year after year.
Others in the group spot some fresh moose tracks.
Is that a fresh one?
Hoof prints in the mud and munched-off aspen are welcome signs, but Mike Schrag worries it could be difficult to evaluate the habitat restoration projects. Earlier this year, Governor Dayton issued an executive order that banned placing GPS collars on moose. Those collars had allowed researchers to track the kind of habitats moose visited.
We're putting a lot of effort into habitat management, a lot of time and a lot of money, and we need to be able to know that it's working. Getting those kinds of answers is a lot harder to do without a lot of research, and a lot of that is best done with collared animals.
Schrag says the Habitat Collaborative is a good start, but the 8,500 acres it plans to treat is a tiny fraction of the hundreds of thousands of acres of moose habitat in the state. Still, Schrag and others say it's worth the effort. Craig Engwald directs the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. The group backs the project because it will create better habitat for deer and other species in addition to moose.
So, yes, it's a good amount of money, but an important amount of money and an investment in trying to save an iconic species in Minnesota.
Whether that investment pays off, that won't be known for several years. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, near Finland, Minnesota.
Dan Olson has another Sounds and Voices segment for us. Kathy Werzer read the intro.
What's more important, football or fine art?
Yes, I enjoy watching football, but I really do enjoy learning from paintings, too.
Dave Marshall is a docent at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum, and he shows there's a lot to learn at the Winona-based institution. Dan Olson paid a visit for a new episode of Minnesota Sounds and Voices.
Dave Marshall did not grow up in privilege.
Upper poverty.
Marshall was a preacher's kid. The family moved among churches in Oklahoma, Texas, and Louisiana every few years. Art appreciation wasn't a priority. The fine art bug bit Marshall in college. He still gushes over the art course.
And this was just an explosion in my mind. We started with the cave paintings and went right straight up to modern art.
77-year-old Dave Marshall knows a lot about art. But when it comes to art expertise, he defers to a man less than half his age, 35-year-old museum director Andrew Mouse. Mouse is excited about one of the museum's recent acquisitions. It's a smaller version of the famous painting that shows the father of our country with his foot on the prow of a boat crossing the Delaware River during the Revolutionary War.
It's depicting George Washington as he's about to plan his attack on Germans who were working for the British government.
Mouse says German painter Emanuel Leutzer gave the historic moment a bit of a rosy treatment. Everyone looks well clothed and fed, when in reality Washington's revolutionaries were hungry and threadbare. There's an African American, an American Indian, and a woman in the boat. Was that how it happened, or did the painter purposely expand the diversity of the crew? Dave Marshall says more than a few viewers noticed the woman.
All the ladies say, look, she's the only one rowing.
There are more than 1,000 works in the Minnesota Marine Art Museum's collection. Realists, impressionists, modernists, and hundreds of works by local and regional artists. Nearly every work has a backstory that could fill a book. Mouse stops at the African-American painter Henry Ossawa Tanner's Summer at the Shore, painted in 1893. Tanner finally won acceptance in this country, but only after going to live in Paris.
He actually left the United States because of the pervasive racism of the day. He was notable for being the first African-American for gaining admission to the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts.
Then there's Max Beckmann's Dutch landscape with bathers. Andrew Mouse remembers thinking, at first glance, how sunny and pretty for a Max Beckmann painting. Before World War II, the Nazis declared Beckmann, among other artists, a degenerate for his edgy and dark works. Beckmann left Germany and hid in Amsterdam during the war, and Mouse points to the corner of the bather's painting for the clue.
You see that individual hiding in the shadows. We believe that to personify Max Beckmann as living in hiding.
The worldwide fine art market is hot. The super rich are driving up prices for the limited supply of coveted works. Andrew Mao says focusing on the cost of acquiring art puts the emphasis in the wrong place. Instead, he says, treasure the opportunity to appreciate an artist's craft and the story behind each work.
There's a tremendous historical value to understanding the time and place that an object was made and the context for which it was made.
The Minnesota Marine Art Museum opened its doors 9 years ago with a collection inspired by water and many works created by regional artists. Money from Winona area business owners and museum members has helped fund acquisitions of art from around the world with all sorts of themes, but many still inspired by water. From Minnesota Sounds and Voices, I'm Dan Olson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Winona.
Last week at nprnews.org, we featured photographs of John Vachon. The St. Paul native worked for the Farm Security Administration during the late 1930s and early 1940s and documented American life and how government relief programs were helping those struggling through the Great Depression. Back in 1964, John Vachon was interviewed for the Smithsonian Institution's Archives of American Art. Here he tells the interviewer about his first job with the FSA.
I remember the title of the job was messenger, but the duties, Roy explained to me that day, telling me that they were going to be very dull, would be to write captions on the back of 8x10 photographs. The captions being on file cards, which I would copy. So I did that for a month. And, occasionally would turn the picture over and look at it. Mostly I just took the number to write those captions on the backs of the pictures.
Had you heard anything about what resettlement was doing before you started?
I had no idea what they were doing.
You had no interest in pictures or in resettlement as such?
No, none at all.
Anything of the kind. Well, how long did you work with the file then before you started taking pictures yourself?
Well, it was, within a few months I got interested in the pictures themselves. Mm-hmm. And began to, know one photographer's work from the other and admire certain pictures. And it was in the spring of the next year, 37, when I asked Stryker if I could use a camera around, just to see what I could do with it, which I had never in my life done or wanted to do before. So I borrowed a camera and took pictures around Washington for most of that summer, on my own.
You can still see some of Vachon's photos from Minnesota on our website, nprnews.org. And that's the NPR News Update podcast for Tuesday, May 26th. I'm Phil Picardi, back with the Wednesday news.